This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Rob Stewart blew into world consciousness with his award-winning indie film Sharkwater. As a result of that movie and Stewart's unrelenting campaign, dozens of countries and many more cities have banned shark fin soup, the alleged delicacy wiping out the ocean's top predator. Now Stewart is back for a much bigger fight, the fight of our lives, how to steer a death-wish civilization in a better direction. His new movie, 4 Years in the Making, was released at the Toronto International Film Festival and again at the Vancouver Film Festival. It's called Revolution. Rob, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Sharkwater was one of the biggest-selling Canadian films ever. It ricocheted all around the world. What are the latest developments in saving the sharks?
Well, the number of countries that have banned shark finning went from 16 when we released Sharkwater to more than 100. There's at least 25 territories that have banned shark fin where you can't even own it. And China has banned shark fin soup at all government functions, which is a significant start in getting shark fin soup banned in China. So I think a lot of good is happening, but you know, there's still a lot more work to be done, for sure.
I just saw your new movie, Revolution. You don't seem like the anarchist type. What kind of revolution are you talking about?
We need to change almost everything about what it is to be a civilized human right now. We're facing a pretty devastating future if we continue business as usual, and I'm sure you know, but you know, by the middle of the century, we face a world with no fish, no reefs, no rainforest, and 9 billion people on a planet that can't even sustain the 7 billion that are here currently. So it's changed, really, conservation. It's not just hugging trees and saving pandas anymore. We've got to save ourselves. And so the revolution we're talking about in the movie is, you know, how are we gonna survive this extinction? What do we need to do to turn this around? And, how do we make this planet of ours paradise, not just for us, but for millions of other species?
Okay, well, maybe we should step back a bit. You were touring with Sharkwater, finally made it to China, where shark fins become soup. And yet, in your moment of triumph in Hong Kong, you died a little on stage. Why was that?
At the movie premiere, when we were at the highlight of my life, 120 million people are about to see Sharkwater, and a woman in the audience puts up her hand and says, "Why stop us from eating shark fin soup if, according to the UN, all the fish are going to be gone by 2048? Citing studies done by Boris Worm at Dalhousie University in Halifax, stating that if current fishing trends continue, you could, you know, wipe out all the fisheries. And that sort of launched the journey in this movie, because I've been trying to figure out, you know, what to do next and how to follow up on this. But I'd also met some of these scientists, and what they said was, what you're doing is awesome, but you're missing the point. You know, we're going to lose everything, not just sharks. So it was a pretty great starting point for us and a bit of an insight to me in terms of, you know, what this next movie and what our next sort of mission has to be as a species.
I found myself sort of staring at some of your underwater shots. I wanted to rerun them right there in the theater. They were so amazing. You won my heart with an unlikely hero, the flamboyant cuttlefish. What makes that creature so amazing?
Flamboyant cuttlefish are incredible. They're one of my favorite species in the world. They are, cephalopods are 600 million years old, so they've survived 5 major extinctions. But the flamboyant cuttlefish is at the very pinnacle of cephalopod evolution. They're quite recent, and they're the first poisonous cephalopod in the world. And cephalopods, cuttlefish, are related to squids and octopus, and they're really smart. They're smarter than house cats, and they communicate with each other and with other species. They use their bodies as banners for their emotions. So they'll flash colors on the sides of their bodies to talk to other cuttlefish, and they actually use their arms to sign language. And studies, researchers in Australia have recorded 68 distinct hand signals that cuttlefish will make to us when we make a distinct hand signal to them. So they're trying to talk to us, we just don't know what they're saying. And they're gorgeous little bright red and orange and yellow creatures, and yeah, they're amazing.
And slightly poisonous.
Yes, very poisonous.
I'd like to ask you about one claim made in the film. You say coral reefs could be mostly dead in 40 years or less. I've just seen a YouTube lecture by Professor Alexander Tudhope. He's a geoscientist and climatologist from the University of Edinburgh. He seemed less certain about the coral fate, suggesting they could die off, but it's still possible they may adapt enough to survive. Who are the sources you consulted, and what are they telling you about the future of coral?
The sources we went with were a guy named Charlie Varin, who's considered the godfather of coral. He's named at least a quarter of all the world's coral species. Katerina Fabricius, who is the lead scientist at the Australian Institute of Marine Sciences, and Ove Hogelberg, who's another one of Australia's leading coral and acidification scientists. And what they said was a lot of the carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere gets absorbed by the oceans, making the oceans 30% more acidic than they were 100 years ago. And in a world that is increasing in acidity this fast, animals can't, you know, respond and build skeletons and shells in this world. And sure, the oceans have been more acidic in the past, but we're changing the ocean acidity so quickly that the animals can't possibly evolve to this. And at current trajectories of our emissions, all the coral reefs, well, coral reefs become soluble. They start dissolving at 2070. So coral reefs are sort of succumbing to a triple threat right now. They're getting hit by coral bleaching due to ocean warming, runoff from industry and agriculture and crown of thorns starfish, and ocean acidification. And so it's tough to pull any one of those variables out. But the scientists we were talking about think that if current trajectories continue, we'll be, you know, in a world without coral reefs sometime around the middle of the century.
And you had some amazing interviews in the movie. Can you tell us about just a couple of people you met and filmed for Revolution?
Yeah, we met and filmed Boris Worm from Dalhousie University in Halifax, who was responsible for finding out that 90% of the world's large fish are gone and that we could lose all the world's fisheries by the middle of the century if fishing continues. We met Felix Finkbeiner of an organization called Plant for the Planet, who is a 13-year-old who is hell-bent on planting 10 million trees in every country in the world and has, you know, amassed quite a following among youth and adults all around the world. And I also had the opportunity to work with youth delegations and youth groups that are working to fight environmental battles and fight climate issues. And that was probably some of the most inspiring people we met because they don't try to rationalize themselves out of any of the issues. They don't try to, you know, save the environment while retaining economic growth. Or they don't, you know, try to keep the almighty buck ahead of everything else. They just want to get involved and do something and turn this around. And they firmly believe we're going to do it. We're going to do it in this lifetime. And they're, you know, enlisting all their friends and family in it.
Yeah, in the film you suggest only the real victims of fossil fuels will be motivated enough to change the way we live. So you think that young people may be the most likely to save us?
Every revolution in the past, the people that have pushed that revolution were the people most directly impacted by the atrocity. And it's going to be the same in this revolution. You know, young people can imagine the world in 2050 with no fish, no reefs, no rainforest, and want to do something about that. You know, they're going to want to have families, or they're going to imagine their future. And so I really do think that, you know, it's going to be the youth that are taking a stand and stepping up and taking the future back from the adults of today. And many adults, you know, like we are involved in the destruction of our life support systems. You know, we've got cars and we're working for companies that aren't necessarily good for the planet. We've got mortgages. We're in it. But I think the young people, you know, without any of those blocks on their shoulders, can just simply say, oh, we've got to do something about this. Let's take a step forward and make the world a better place.
And when I saw your coverage of activist protests from the UN climate talks in Mexico to Washington, D.C., I started to wonder, are we going to have to arrest our children to keep on polluting? Is that what it's coming to, Rob?
Are we going to have to arrest our children?
Well, yeah. It looks like young people are just being put on the bus and hauled away as they try and tell us how to be more sane.
Well, that's part of the problem right now, is the way the system is set up, you know, the governments and corporations are often making money off the way things are going. And the way things are going is enormously profitable. I mean, destroying the world we depend on for survival, taking the natural world, packaging it up and selling it to people is enormously profitable. And so one stat we have in the movie is that 51 of the world's 100 biggest economies are corporations. So they're going to be doing battle to try to keep their ecosystem or keep their economic system going, where the young people are going to be, you know, quite opposed to that. So, I mean, it might come down to that sort of generational revolution, but I think it's definitely one where the youth have the power and they've got, you know, life and evolution on their side, where the corporations, you know, they don't have any of that.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is documentary filmmaker and ocean activist Rob Stewart. His new film is called Revolution. In some ways, Rob, you needed the same underground film technique so successful in Sharkwater. Why do we still need to slink around without permits to document this greatest threat to humanity and maybe all species?
There's a lot of vested interests at stake, for sure. So, you know, when you want to film some of these things, people are going to start questioning, why are you filming it and what are you going to do with just footage and this material? I mean, making Revolution was quite tough. I thought because Sharkwater had some success that it would be easy to get our next movie off the ground, but it wasn't. It turned out people were, it seemed even less interested in saving humans than they were in saving sharks. And, you know, some of the things that we point to in the movie are pretty revolutionary. They're pretty big. I mean, we've got to change a lot, and I think, you know, part of that change is going to even out a bit of the wealth in the world. And so, you know, there's going to be some people against that.
And did that affect your film financing?
It did, yeah. We had $5 million to make this movie. We were shooting it all in 3D. It was going to be, you know, the big, giant vision I had. And then I was spray-painted green, emceeing a big environmental rally in Ottawa, and saying, you know, it was called Fill the Hill Sea Day, or Power Shift, and I was saying, you know, we don't just need Priuses and recycling, we need a revolution, we've got to change everything, and then all of our money fell away, and we went from having $5 million to having $150,000 overnight because of how radical the movie became. And so it was a major, major setback, and part of the reason why Revolution took 4 years to make was we had to do it in a guerrilla fashion. But it also, you know, re-strengthened my resolve and got us, you know, pitted up against, you know, and to do the battle we kind of need to do.
And talk to us just a little bit about your relationship with another ocean defender. He's currently on the run, even though I think he should be rewarded by society, and that's Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Society.
Paul's one of my heroes. We worked together in creating Sharkwater. And it was Paul, you know, colliding with a Guatemalan fishing boat and us getting charged with attempted murder that really, you know, gave Sharkwater that crazy story. But because of that incident that happened in 2002, Costa Rica reissued arrest warrants for Paul, and he was arrested in Germany earlier this year and is now an international fugitive because Costa Rica wants to bring him back to Costa Rica to face trial, where he will, you know, undoubtedly probably not face a fair trial due to the shark fin industry in Costa Rica. So I think Paul's an absolute hero, and I think, you know, what could come of this, you know, if he can't hit, you know, if he can't come into port, then he becomes the vigilante renegade eco-hero that we all want him to be.
He's still out there at sea, and I hope he's doing well. Rob Stewart, what tipped your journey from a self-described nerd with a camera to such an activist stance, even a revolutionary?
I think it's just the knowledge. I mean, I would happily go back to my life as a wildlife photographer taking pictures of fish, but I know a lot more now, and with that knowledge, I can't do anything but educate people and try to get everybody to know what we're doing and where we're going and how to get out of it. I mean, I think this is the biggest issue humanity's ever faced, and possibly the biggest issue any species has ever faced. And, you know, it's going to take a lot of us, all of us, coming together to figure out how to do this and to turn this around, because we're, in a way, going up against the biggest corporations and governments in the world, but we're fighting for all the ecosystems and species in the world. And so, you know, I think we've got a massive opportunity in this to step it up as a species and learn what it is to be human and work together and put other things ahead of profits. And I think that, you know, all this is probable and possible within our lifetimes, and that the young people particularly can see a future where we figure this out and we fix the design flaws of this pre-revolutionary civilization. And we live in a world that's paradise on Earth, not just for us, but for millions of other species.
Yeah, you'd think even the possibility of something like mass extinction would get people's attention, but it seemed the Kardashians get more print. Do you think it's too extreme to describe ourselves as living in a death culture?
Oof. Yeah, I would. but, I mean, it's all a matter of perspective, whatever you take on it. I mean, I don't think we live in that culture at all. I think We set up a system on this planet, a system of economy, a system of corporations, a system of government, when we had infinite space and infinite resources. You know, so when there were a few hundred million people on Earth, we could do whatever we want. But now that there's 7 billion of us, we're running up against significant barriers. And that model we created a thousand years ago just isn't effective. So I don't think we live in a death culture by any means. I think we live in a beautiful culture where, you know, people are connected and they're sharing stories and sharing insight and wisdom, and we're learning and we're growing and evolving. I just think if everybody knew what was actually happening, if everybody knew that our consumption patterns, our governments, our corporations were running amok and destroying our life support system, they would take radically different decisions, elect different officials, support different corporations, and their emotions would guide them to making better decisions. They would feel bad about things that were destructive for the environment and good about things that were good for the planet. And I think, you know, once we let our emotions guide us, then we'll be on the right path. So I really do think we live in a pretty beautiful world that's full of immense possibilities, and we are going to turn this around.
You just published a book as well. Tell us a little bit about Save the Humans.
Save the Humans is sort of part autobiography, part backstory of Sharkwater and Revolution. Making movies is enormously difficult, and what goes into the other side of it is definitely as dramatic as what happens in the movies. And I thought if I could bring people on the journey that I went on as a young fish nerd, falling in love with the ocean, figuring out it's in jeopardy and trying to do something about it, and arriving at this position of hope where I'm at now, that people would come along on that journey and then come to the same conclusions that I have, that we're in a really serious predicament. We've got to turn this around. We're going to do it. And so I was hoping by writing a book, Save the Humans, that I could impart a little bit of that journey and, you know, paint a bright picture of where we could go. Because I think instead of trying to be adversarial in all this and trying to, you know, fight against corporations and against governments and try to stop these environmental disasters from happening, if we start focusing on what if we got this right, what if we made Earth paradise for us and millions of other species, what if we went to the rivers and the lakes for fish and the oceans for fish instead of salmon farms, what if we ate locally, what if we had green roofs everywhere, what if our economy was focused on sustainability and ecosystem restoration. I mean, I think this could be a beautiful world we live in, and so I'm trying to bring people that story.
And it's a good story, and I know you're working insane hours to get your message out, and you're calling for help with a new environment group, the United Conservationists. What is that?
United Conservationists is our way to help show people how to change the world. Well, what we realized in making Sharkwater is that changing the world isn't that hard. It's just we haven't tried yet. And the amount of countries that have banned shark fin soup rose dramatically, and a lot of it was led by kids. So we started this little charity, United Conservationists, to try to show people how to change the world the way they want to change the world, and to, you know, make them sort of part of a bigger community of conservationists that are united to, you know, to make the world a better place.
How will folks get to see your new movie, Revolution?
Revolution hits theaters across Canada, Earth Day 2013 in April.
Well, listeners, I've got links to Rob's work in my show blog at ecoshock.info. You can find the film website at therevolutionmovie.com and try unitedconservationists.org. Rob Stewart, I loved the movie. It's deep and necessary. I hope it storms the world. Thank you for spending time with Radio EcoShock listeners.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Hey, this is Alex. I've got Lester Brown coming up in an exclusive press briefing about the world food situation, plus Wes Regan on localizing food right here in Vancouver's downtown East Side. As you know, food prices are rising rapidly in every country. Why? Lester Brown is an expert who has tracked world food production for decades. Radio EcoShock has this exclusive report from Lester's briefing for the international press on September 27, 2012. Lester is introduced by Kaylee Crater of the Earth Policy Institute.
It's really my honor today to introduce Lester Brown, who's been described as one of the world's most influential thinkers by the Washington Post. He is the founder and president of the Earth Policy Institute, a nonprofit environmental research organization based in Washington, D.C. During a career that started with tomato farming, Lester Brown has been awarded 25 honorary degrees and has authored or co-authored 50 books. He's one of the world's most widely published authors, and his books have appeared in 40 languages. The book you're going to hear about today is entitled Full Planet, Empty Plates, The New Geopolitics of Food Scarcity. He is a MacArthur Fellow, and in 1985, the Library of Congress requested his personal papers, noting that his writings and work had already strongly affected thinking about the problems of world population and resources. So, Lester, please go ahead and tell us more about your book.
Thanks, Kaylee. The thesis of Full Planet, Empty Plates is that the world is in a transition from an age dominated by surpluses, that was basically the last half of the last century, to one that's increasingly going to be dominated by scarcity. This year, we had a near-record all-time drought in the United States, one that led to a reduction in the world grain harvest of 73 million tons. To put that in perspective, that's roughly equal to the grain harvest of Canada and Australia combined. So it was not a trivial loss. And it's left the world in a situation of rising prices for both corn and soybeans. Food prices are rising worldwide. Those of us in this country aren't affected that much when the price of wheat doubles, because we are insulated by all the processing that takes place between the wheat that leaves the farm and the wheat in the bread when it reaches our table. Beyond that, we only spend 10% of our income on food anyhow, so it doesn't have a huge effect on us. But in some parts of the world where people spend 50 to 70% of their income on food and the price of wheat doubles, they're in trouble. And we're seeing this not only lead to a cutback in consumption and then going to one meal a day, which is what's typically happened in the past when things got tight, but there are a growing number of families now that are scheduling foodless days, days when they will not actually eat anything. A survey by Save the Children shows that in India, 24% of all families now routinely schedule foodless days. They may decide at the beginning of the week they won't eat on Wednesday and Saturday, for example. In Nigeria, 27% of families now plan foodless days. In Peru, it's 14%. So this is sort of a new step in human deprivation in terms of food consumption. And it's a worrying one because it's affecting such large numbers of people. When we go back and look back over the last several years, we see that in 2007, 2008, we had a doubling of world grain prices. At that time, exporters began to restrict exports. Russia and Argentina for wheat, for example, Vietnam, the world's leading rice exporter. And then importing countries panicked because they suddenly realized they could not rely on the market to get the food they need. That translated into the land rush. Countries buying land, importing countries buying land in other countries on which to produce food for themselves. These land grabs, as of a year or so ago, totaled at least 160 million acres. That's equal to the wheat and corn area combined in the United States. So it's not a trivial amount of land at stake here. But food prices have not returned to the norm. We now see, and I mentioned this in the book, food is becoming the new oil. The competition for access to food is becoming intense in many cases. And land is the new gold. Investing in land has been a good bet now for the last several years. In fact, land prices are going up about twice as fast as the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Why suddenly is all this happening? Why are we running into so much trouble on the food front? Well, on the demand side, we're seeing record growth in the demand for grain. Some of it's population growth. We're adding 80 million people a year. That's not new. We've been doing that for the last few decades. 219,000 people will be at the dinner table tonight who were not there last night. And this adds up. Population growth adds up to relentless mounting pressure on the earth's land and water resources. Then we had this great idea in the United States of using grain to produce fuel for cars. And because of that, last year we harvested about 400 million tons of grain, and 129 million tons went to ethanol distilleries. In this country, we are now using more corn to fuel cars than we are to feed livestock and poultry. So it is squeezing food supplies in this country, and therefore, because we're such a major exporter, it's affecting the entire world. The third thing, after population growth and using grain to fuel cars, is rising affluence. We can best understand this by looking at grain consumption in a low-income society and in a high-income society. In India, annual grain consumption is about 400 pounds, or about a pound a day. When you have only a pound of grain a day, you consume almost all of that directly just to keep body and soul together. You can't afford to convert much of it into animal protein. In the United States, we use about 1,600 pounds of grain per year. Of that, we consume maybe 200 pounds directly as bread and breakfast cereals and so forth. But the bulk of that is converted into animal protein, into meat, milk, and eggs. What we are now seeing in the world is roughly 3 billion people trying to move up the food chain, consuming more grain-intensive livestock products. We see this most dramatically in China, where China's meat consumption, which, say, 15 years ago was less than that of the United States, has now doubled that of the United States. And it is this huge number of people moving up the food chain, consuming more grain-intensive, i.e. corn-intensive livestock products, that has made corn the world's leading grain. Historically, it was the big three grains, wheat, rice, and corn. Wheat and rice are food grains. Corn is a feed grain. But corn is now by far the leader at about 900 million tons, a third larger than wheat and nearly double the world rice harvest. So we have demand growing at a record rate. And over the last decade, the annual growth in world demand for grain has jumped from 21 million tons a year to 41 million tons a year. So now the world's farmers are scrambling to come up with another 41 million tons per year of grain production. And that's against a world production base of about 2 billion tons of grain a year. On the supply side, we have four factors now that are making it more difficult to expand production. One is water shortages. Half the world's people live in countries where water tables are falling as a result of overpumping, mostly for irrigation. In the Arab Middle East, this would include Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Iraq, Jordan. In those countries, water shortages, falling water tables, irrigation wells going dry are leading to a shrinkage of the grain harvest in that region. So for the first time, we have sort of a sub-region of the world, namely the Arab Middle East, where grain production is falling because of water shortages. There are also water shortages in the big three grain producers. The World Bank estimates that 175 million people in India are being fed with grain produced by overpumping. My estimate for China is that 120 million Chinese are now being fed with grain produced by overpumping. Overpumping is by definition a short-term phenomenon. You can't overpump forever because eventually the aquifers go dry, the wells go dry, and then the rate of pumping is necessarily limited by the rate of aquifer recharge. In the U.S., we see leading agricultural states like Texas and California with shrinking irrigated area. They've probably each lost 15%, maybe 20% of their irrigated area over the last decade or two. And these are our two big agricultural states. They're losing irrigation water, both because of aquifer depletion and also because more and more irrigation water is being diverted to cities. So water shortages are a big factor influencing our capacity to expand production in the future. The second factor is climate change. There's a rule of thumb that for each 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature above the norm during the growing season, we can expect a 10% decline in grain yields. It now turns out that, if anything, that rule of thumb is conservative. The drop in harvest as a result of a 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature may be greater than 10%. Photosynthesis is affected by temperature. From 68 degrees to 95 degrees, photosynthesis is very stable. But once temperature goes above 95 degrees, photosynthesis begins to decline. When you hit 104 degrees, there's no photosynthesis at all. At that point, the plant goes into thermal shock. There's no growth. It's just surviving.
This is Radio EcoShock. We'll be right back with more from Lester Brown on the developing world food crisis, followed by an interview about helping even the poorest parts of town recover with urban food production. Stay tuned.